The World Health Organization declares COVID-19 a pandemic, and Italy is on lockdown.
It went so quickly from, oh, it's kind of life is normal and there's a small quarantine area in these towns outside Milan, to an entire Western European democratic country is on lockdown.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, and today on The Takeaway for March 11th, find out how past epidemics impacted the design of our cities.
Until now, we really haven't thought about sanitation and infectious disease in cities in the United States and the developed world. And that's because much of our sanitary infrastructure is the same that's been installed in cities just after the Industrial Revolution.
Also on the podcast, another big night for Joe Biden.
Everything that has made America, America, is truly at stake.
Plus, a conversation with Anise Parker, one of the first out mayors of a major American city. Hear her talk about running a campaign as an LGBTQ candidate. All that plus your takes. Let's start with coronavirus in Italy.
The city center looks like a demilitarized zone, and that's an unreal sight if I ever saw one.
The World Health Organization has officially declared coronavirus a pandemic. Earlier this week, Italy became the first country to put in place a nationwide lockdown. The novel coronavirus keeps spreading there and across the globe. COVID-19 has already killed more than 600 people in Italy, and the numbers are growing. Right now, roughly 10,000 people there are infected. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte ordered the country's 60 million people to stay home. He's also said, quote, "We are forced to impose sacrifices."
Noi quindi non possiamo più permetterci in queste aree aggregazioni di persone.
Conte is calling this Italy's darkest hour. He was borrowing a phrase from Winston Churchill during World War II, which was the last time restrictions of movement at this scale were imposed in Europe. COVID-19 is changing how we live. Already, lockdowns on a much smaller scale are popping up around the world. In China, where the outbreak first began, the government locked down specific cities and provinces, but not the whole country. This week, New York is creating what it calls, quote, a containment area in New Rochelle. A growing number of infected people live in that New York City suburb. Back in Italy, very few people leave their homes these days.
Florence as a whole, just like the rest of the country, has had to face a dramatic and very sudden increase in the level of perceived danger.
Giovanni Elia lives in Florence, Italy, on lockdown.
Some of my clients have put their businesses in stasis, so to speak, and therefore the amount of work that they have has gone down markedly. On a personal level, I have some elder relatives, first of all my parents, and I've been trying to help them out in any way I can when it comes to their daily needs, so that they have to go out as little as possible. There are definitely a lot less people in public.
Let's make sense of that sight. Rachel Donadio is a contributing writer for The Atlantic. She covers politics and culture across Europe. Also with us is a reporter based in Rome. Crispian Balmer is chief Italy correspondent for Reuters. Crispian, Rachel, hello.
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 So, Crispian, what exactly does the lockdown entail, and how do you enforce something like that?
The Italian government has said that all non-essential travel is banned. So people can go to work, but they'd prefer people to work from home if possible. Can't move from region to region unless you carry a certificate that you yourself have printed from home that gives a reason for the movement. Flights abroad, you've got to again have an emergency or health reason to undertake longer journeys. So far, the Italian government is relying upon civic duty. It's been sending messages around saying the country faces a crisis like we haven't seen in generations, and you need to play your part. It remains to be seen whether that can continue for the next 3 weeks.
You mentioned these certificates that you print from home. I am assuming from an online source. How do we know that these certificates are not forged? Is there anyone who actually approves this? And are there penalties for people who actually break the quarantine?
The government says that if the police stop you and check your certificate, check what your story, then they can follow that up at a later date. And if it's proved that you aren't going to a place of work, if your company is saying, no, that's not true, then you face possible fines and even jail time. I think they're talking up to 3 months in jail.
And speaking of jail, we understand that there have been some riots in prisons. What's the latest on that?
I think 12 people have died in these riots. All of them, I believe, came when inmates broke into a health facility at one prison in Modena in the north and basically overdosed on what they found there. Just seems to be mass overdosing. But the rioting was widespread in 25 prisons across the country, and it seems to be being sparked by restrictions imposed by the authorities because of coronavirus. And Italian prisons are incredibly overcrowded, I think something like 120, 130% beyond their expected capacity. So there's fear there as well that if coronavirus enters the prisons, it could rip through them incredibly quickly.
Rachel, why did the Italian government think that a nationwide lockdown was necessary? What's the logic there?
The logic is that this is a highly contagious disease. Some people have very few symptoms, and other people need emergency respiration in the ICU, and it's overwhelming the intensive care units at hospitals. In the area of Bergamo, which is kind of like the Greenwich, Connecticut of Italy, it's a rich bedroom community of Milan, and the hospitals there are overwhelmed, and the number of deaths are going up, and really, this is a infectious disease, and there's no cure for it.
Were you surprised that it got to this point, Rachel?
Yes. I mean, on February 27th, the head of the center-left Democratic Party went to Milan to show solidarity and drink an aperitivo and say, Milan doesn't stop, everything is fine. And he, on Saturday, announced he had come down with the virus, and it went so quickly from, oh, it's kind of life is normal and there's a small quarantine area in these towns outside Milan, to an entire Western European democratic country is on lockdown. Now, as Crispian said, it's not martial law. The police are not going door to door to make sure that everyone is staying home. And you can still circulate and go to grocery stores and move around if you have to. But it is a really, really strong deterrent measure just to say we really need to shut down in order to prevent the flow of this virus. I did not expect it to go so fast, and I did not expect it to be so extreme so quickly.
So, Rachel, that begs a question. Are we likely to see more lockdowns, say, in France, in Germany? Because, as you say, this is spreading around the world and everyone's likely to get it?
I mean, I think that every country is responding differently to this. I think there's been a lot of denial, and European countries are waking up to it. I think France is still downplaying it. It says, oh, if President Macron has said if we need to go to level 3, which means, you know, closing of public events, then we will. But it hasn't gotten there yet. In Germany, they announced in Berlin that theaters and museums would be closed until a certain point in April. So it's slowly starting. I don't know if we'll see anything as widespread as the lockdown in Italy. I think that each country is kind of trying to evaluate balancing lives and livelihoods, because this is wreaking devastating havoc on economies, obviously, but so would a high death count.
So, Crispian, there's a lot of talk that this virus is an import to a lot of countries around the world. In Europe, we've seen a rise in far-right political extremism, particularly in Italy. Is this playing out among groups right now in the shadow of the coronavirus?
I don't see it. I think there's a lot of confusion amongst the far right as to how to respond to this problem. And Salvini, who's the head of the League, was saying a couple of weeks ago, everything's got to reopen. This is ridiculous. But the borders should shut to stop the virus coming in. Now he's saying everything must close, but he's being outraged because the borders have shut to prevent the Italians getting out. So there's a bit of a mixed message, a bit of confusion about this. But that said, I mean, I think when this settles down, you know, this is a problem that perhaps comes from globalization. It spread around the globe incredibly quickly. And I think there will be more calls to bring more production back, bring the focus of the industry, the economy, back to individual countries to try to protect them from the outside world. But I think right now, all the attention really is on tackling the initial emergency.
Rachel, the demographics of Italy are fairly unique in the world. It has one of the highest concentrations of older people. How much is the death rate, if at all, linked to Italy's elderly population?
The majority of the deaths from COVID-19 in Italy are of people over the age of 70, and they're mostly, those have been in the Lombardy region. I think that that is definitely a factor in why the death rate has been so high in Italy. It has affected older people, and those older people haven't pulled through. But I also think it's going to be a question of intensive care unit capacity and whether they can handle that. There are a lot of There's a lot of speculation now about why things went so fast in Italy and why the death rate's so high. I do think the fact that Italy has the oldest population in the world after Japan is a factor, but it's not the only factor.
Crispin, how are people reacting to the lockdown in Rome?
I think that there's been, from my point of view, almost surprising support. It was an opinion poll I saw this morning that said more than 80% of people, even 86% of people, supported the government action. And something like 75% said that they thought that, you know, even further restrictions would be necessary and they would back them. I think that the small businesses, restaurant owners, bar owners, they are deeply worried because they fear that they will go out of business. They've got to pay rent, they've got to pay staff, they've got to pay utility bills, and there's just nobody around. I mean, all restaurants and bars have to shut at 6 p.m. all over the country. And, you know, Italy has got 150,000 plus bars and goodness knows how many restaurants. So a lot of people are facing really serious economic hardship, and that is frightening for them. But globally, you know, the streets here, Rome, Italians have got a reputation for being, you know, they don't really respect the rules. They don't really, you know, queuing isn't something that comes naturally to them. But, you know, if you go outside a pharmacy or a supermarket, I've seen this morning people queuing respectfully with a 1 meter distance but between them. They seem to have taken this on board.
So what lessons can the U.S. and other Western countries, for that matter, learn from how Italy is handling this outbreak?
Don't downplay, wash your hands, take this seriously. It's worse than the flu.
Yeah, I was thinking it's very interesting. I think there are two kind of philosophies. In Britain, the message seems to be keep calm and carry on, the kind of the old World War II message, whereas in Italy, it's keep calm and stop. And I think, you know, we will soon find out which of those two messages is the better. But certainly don't underestimate it. The images from the Italian intensive care units are very sobering. And I was struck, the patient number one was a 38-year-old, incredibly fit young man, an athlete. He came down, he went to hospital on something like the 19th of February. They announced yesterday that he was finally off the ventilator, that he could breathe by himself. So, you know, this is something that lingers, it's something that's highly infectious, and it's something that you really, really shouldn't underestimate.
Crispin Balmer is chief Italy correspondent for Reuters, and Rachel Donadio is a contributing writer to The Atlantic, covering politics and culture across Europe. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
In August, we took a look at how mass shootings in the U.S. may be making you uncomfortable in public spaces like movie theaters, music festivals, and churches. Well, today, people are also having a difficult time navigating public spaces because of coronavirus fears. This week, Democratic candidates Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden canceled events because of risks associated with the coronavirus, and Washington Governor Jay Inslee is now planning to ban gatherings of more than 250 people in Seattle. As COVID-19 continues to spread, let's take a look at how people are navigating public spaces. Sarah Jensen Carr is an assistant professor of architecture, urbanism, and landscape at Northeastern University. Sarah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Some people describe cities as incubators for diseases. How does the design of our cities impact the spread of diseases?
So the thought of cities as being an unhealthy place to inhabit really dates back to around the Industrial Revolution. You know, if you think about back then, there was a lack of coordinated waste removal. There was lots of sewage in the streets. And so just the very act of people were very crowded as well in tenement housing. So, you know, just the very act of living in the city was thought to be unhealthy. Cholera, yellow fever, other filth diseases really racked dense urban areas. The effect of cholera and yellow fever, though, what it did do was it spurred a massive infrastructural reinvention of cities. So, you know, that was around the time we had a lot of our waste infrastructure built in the United States. So, you know, moving pipes underground. In a lot of cities, they even changed streets from cobblestones to smooth pavement, as it was thought the space in between the cobblestones could hold germs, and smooth pavement made it easier to wash down streets. That said, you know, the thought of cities as incubators in disease really persisted, I would say, into the late 20th century. Even though, you know, I would say until now, we really haven't thought about sanitation and infectious disease in cities in the United States and the developed world. And that's because much of our infrastructure, sanitary infrastructure, is the same that's been installed in cities just after the Industrial Revolution. So it's interesting to have this conversation now, where this sort of like fear of density is coming back, and you know, these concerns about sanitation.
So the so-called fear of density, do you think that the mass closure and avoidance of public spaces throughout the country, really around the world, is an overreaction to the coronavirus?
I mean, we don't know, right? Right now we're in this complete state of uncertainty, and any uncertainty causes the most panic when we don't know the vectors. I can't say it's an overreaction. You know, what's most important now is to just sort of, you know, flatten that curve and not overtax our health system.
Do you think that, you know, the way the global response has been occurring now is in any way different from the way we've responded to other health crises that may be linked to density?
You know, first I'll say I've written about the cholera epidemic and other epidemics and how that's transformed the American urban landscape. What's important to realize is that the built environment, our public space, our streets, our buildings, in terms of reacting to diseases, that often doesn't happen until 10 years down the road, and then we don't see the effects of that another 10 years later. And some of those interventions did not work. They were actually detrimental to health. I certainly hope that COVID-19 does not last that long. So we'll see. We're just sort of in the beginning of this right now and seeing what happens.
When you say some changes to cities in response to diseases were detrimental to health, can you give me an example?
Yeah, well, even though the sanitation movement did transform our cities much for, you know, for the better, and also required a coordinated response between public health departments and urban planning departments, which, you know, hadn't been seen before and honestly hasn't been seen a lot since. We're still trying to coordinate those departments to think about public health in our cities. It also resulted in the massive displacement, mostly of the working class and immigrant neighborhoods. And so, you know, thinking about if we do make interventions in the built environment, how do we do it equitably is very important.
The Takeaway did a segment about the impact mass shootings have on our relationship to these public spaces. Do you think that the coronavirus will change the way we view public spaces as safe?
I think the conversation, thinking about transmission of the coronavirus in public, I think it's more concentrated on public transportation right now because there's a lot more surfaces. I mean, one thing that we don't have in public spaces, there's not a lot of surfaces to touch, right? You're mostly sitting or you're mostly walking through it. I mean, that said, you know, just anecdotally, I noticed the playground in my neighborhood was a little bit more empty this past weekend. But, you know, as we're just at the beginning of this, it's very hard to tell right now what the net effect will be.
And finally, what should we be talking about with our friends and family if we're feeling anxious about going into public spaces?
Well, wash your hands. You know, I have three small children, so that's a constant conversation in my house right now. But I think also, you know, even though for a large portion of the population, maybe asymptomatic, but thinking about, you know, how we go out in public space right now can affect those that are most vulnerable. That's a very important conversation to have. What actions, you know, do we take personally, even though they may not come back to affect us right away, but how are they affecting those most vulnerable? And that's a conversation we should be having, you know, not just for epidemics, but, you know, very pressing issues like climate change as well.
Sarah Jensen-Carr is an assistant professor of architecture, urbanism, and landscape at Northeastern University. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Duarte.
So is coronavirus changing the way you navigate public spaces? You're talking to us about it.
Hi, this is Patrick from Portland, Oregon. Overall, still going to concerts, restaurants, and unfortunately due to work, navigating hospitals every now and then.
Hi, this is Rachel from Louisville, Kentucky. My toddlers and I have been battling colds on and off since December. Now, I know that some people will freak out if we are at a gathering and we start coughing, and I have chosen not to go to some events.
My name is Kat Meisler, and I'm calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. I've canceled a trip to Chicago for fear that I might bring the virus into my mom's home there, and she's 81. Canceling plans to go to a show tonight here in Las Vegas, and I'm debating whether or not to do a trip to California.
My name's Joseph. I'm in Cannes, France, and I just jumped on an airplane Sunday night to head back to France to visit my mother. And I had very empty airports, very empty flights, very good service. And the scare here is pretty intense. They're canceling like the film festivals and other things that are going on locally. So I went to Monte Carlo today and it was very quiet. Hopefully this blows over.
877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up with our elections in 2020? Why do some states caucus and others don't? Who gets to be a delegate? And yes, everyone goes crazy about Super Tuesday, but what is it and why is it so important? I'm Amy Walter, host of How to Vote in America, a new podcast from WNYC Studios. Every episode, we'll tackle one element of this long and twisted election process and try to make sense of what it actually takes to vote in this country. Listen to How to Vote in America wherever you get your podcasts.
Looks like we're going to have another good night. Yeah. With victories in Mississippi, Missouri, Michigan. Just over a week ago, many of the pundits declared that this candidacy was dead. Now we're very much alive. I believe this nation can overcome 4 years of Donald Trump, and given eight, four more years, he'll forever and fundamentally change the very character of this nation. We can't let that happen. But winning means uniting America.
We hit another milestone in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination this week. Six states held primaries. And although we don't know the final delegate count for Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders, former Vice President Biden did widen his delegate lead over Vermont Senator Sanders. Biden won the majority of the six states, including Michigan, which is a crucial battleground state. He did very well with African-American voters and moderate Dems. Bernie, on the other hand, underperformed. He left his campaign at a disadvantage with delegates. Here to break down what the results mean is Claire Malone. She's a senior politics reporter for 538. Claire, welcome.
Great to be here.
So, Claire, break down what we saw in the six states last night.
Well, in short, we saw mostly not a full Biden sweep, but a huge, huge win for him. Michigan in particular, the state with the most delegates up for grabs last night, was a state that Bernie Sanders really needed to win in order to prove that there was still potentially a mathematical path for him to the nomination, or at least to a convention. And Joe Biden won every single county in Michigan. And what we've really seen over the past 10 days, essentially, is a real sort of signal from Democratic voters, you know, even if they might have been Sanders sympathetic or Warren voters, you know, those more progressive ideological people, a lot of them are casting ballots for Joe Biden in part because I think they're signaling that they want to see the end to the primary. They want to see a nominee come out of this. And it's sort of a pragmatic show of force from Democratic primary voters.
You mentioned a mathematical path to the actual nomination. We've been seeing some generational differences among voters. Are young people turning up to vote? And if so, how does that differ with each candidate?
Well, you know, Bernie Sanders has spent a lot of time saying that young voters were going to to turn out and vote for him. And that has not been the case. That's something that his campaign was banking on to sort of bump up voting numbers. And that didn't really come to fruition in the past couple of contests. Joe Biden, on the other hand, has a huge generational problem. He does not have a lot of youth support. I think that's a thing you've seen for the entire tenure of his campaign. And it's certainly, I think, a worry that his campaign has. On the other hand, young voters are sort of historically unreliable constituencies. So while I think it does make some people worry that perhaps in a general election, young voters in the primary might signal a certain sort of tepid feeling that could haunt Joe Biden in the general election, which is not good for Democrats. It really seemed to be kind of a middle-aged and older person's show of strength behind Joe Biden.
So we have the young voters who are an unreliable constituency, as you put it. What about people of color? How are they voting?
People of color have been, black voters have been very consistently behind Joe Biden. And the Biden campaign, you might recall back in the summer, there were a lot of controversies about Joe Biden's history with the crime bill, history of sort of saying clumsy things about race in America. And the Biden campaign kept on saying, look at our numbers with black voters. They're steady. They're going to turn out. And they were right about that. Black voters have really shown consistent support for him, including younger black voters. They did have a little bit less of strong support for Biden, but compared to other young people of different races, but they were still a strong supporter of Biden. Bernie Sanders did make a lot of efforts to reach out to Latino voters, but that's also a tricky constituency right now in American politics. There are less, sort of formalized pathways to turnout. Black voters in America have the institution of black churches, which are often really helpful gathering points for politicians. And I think Sanders trying to make headway in the Latino community was a bit less successful. And black voters are just sort of a core constituency in the Democratic Party that Biden really knew how to tap into and turn out.
Claire, some Sanders supporters claim the deck was always stacked against him. Some are even talking about splitting from the Democrats and having Sanders run as an independent. Is that at all likely? Or did last night mark the end of Sanders' race?
I think this is a really big question mark for Bernie Sanders himself. I do not think that he will ultimately run as an independent. He didn't come out and speak last night after the voting was over, which was an interesting signal. I mean, it's led to a lot of speculation that perhaps he's turning over what to do, whether or not to concede the race, whether or not to, stay in the race for a while. There's a debate this weekend that is going to be between Biden and Sanders, at least for now. But I do think you saw a lot of, I call them kind of Twitter surrogates for Sanders, almost not being very optimistic, right, about the path forward. There is a certain segment of the progressive left that is not very keyed into the establishment mechanisms of the Democratic Party. We saw this in 2016, though, right, that there were some people who were just not enthusiastic when the general election rolled around. But I think it's a real period of contemplation for Sanders right now. And someone like Andrew Yang endorsing Joe Biden last night on television was kind of interesting because Yang supporters had a lot of crossover with Sanders supporters. So who knows?
It's a great period of contemplation. Thank you so much. Claire Malone is a senior politics reporter at 538. Claire, thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Duarte Giraldino. We stay on politics now with a former politician who knows our current electoral landscape very well.
I'm Anise Parker. I'm the president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund and Victory Institute.
As the head of the Victory Fund and Institute, Anise Parker supports LGBTQ politicians in elections across the country. But before that, she was the mayor of Houston, Texas from 2010 to 2016. She was also the first openly LGBTQ person to hold that office.
Tonight, the voters of Houston have opened the door to history. I embrace that. I know what this win means to many of us who never thought we could achieve high office.
That was Mayor Parker right after she was elected. While she never hid her sexuality, she also chose not to make LGBTQ rights a central part of her platform when she was running for mayor.
By the time I ran for mayor of Houston, I'd already been elected six times citywide in Houston, and the city knew I was a lesbian. They knew my wife. They had seen me, and arguably I was the most visible lesbian activist in Houston in the 80s. So it was part of my public persona, and I felt the most important thing was to talk about the issues that were most relevant to Houstonians while being true to who I was.
In many ways, Mayor Parker's approach as an LGBTQ politician is similar to Pete Buttigieg's approach. By the way, Mayor Parker supported Buttigieg in the 2020 primary before he dropped out of the race. Just like Buttigieg, Parker walked a fine line as an openly LGBTQ candidate while running for mayor of Houston in 2009.
I got a combination of attacks from the right for being LGBT, but I was also criticized from the left. I know that I ended up in a runoff with another moderate Democrat, and he outlined a much more aggressive LGBT agenda for his first year in office.
Than you?
Than I did. Yes. In one of our televised debates, it was a question that came up, and he talked about that. And I said, I recognize the importance of those issues, and I was going to work on them, but we were in a crisis, and those were not the primary issues that I thought faced the city of Houston in that first term.
So was he trying to say you weren't gay enough?
I think so. Perhaps, but yeah, I think more truly. He was trying to segment the voters and making a pitch to appeal specifically to LGBT voters. But having been in politics for a very long time and actually been on the ballot 11 times, personally, I've learned a few things. And one is that people want to know that you have an understanding of their lives, but they're not single-issue voters. They want the whole package. And when you begin to pitch certain things to certain communities, you abandon that.
You've been president of the Victory Fund since 2017. How much has the national landscape changed for LGBTQ politicians since you first became Houston's mayor?
Oh, it's changed tremendously in an amazing positive way. But you know, some of that is because of the work of politicians, of people who are LGBT standing up, running for office, representing the community well everywhere. And, you know, you point out that I represented a big blue island in a toxic red sea that is Texas.
Toxic red sea.
It is very toxic, not necessarily to the LGBT community, but in a whole lot of other ways. But our candidates, LGBTQ candidates, win wherever we run when we are the best candidate with the best ideas. There are people who will vote against us, no doubt, because of who we are. And I don't know that there's anybody who votes for us because of who we are. But for most voters, it may be a data point. And if we give them enough other data points on the positive side, it's not a factor.
The Victory Fund endorsed Pete Buttigieg for president. And you say that, you know, LGBTQ candidates win wherever they're the best person. In retrospect, was he the best person?
I absolutely believe that he was the best candidate for president of the United States. And we endorsed him. And to give you a little bit about the Victory Fund and Victory Institute, both of which I run, Victory Fund's a PAC. We only work with LGBT candidates. We are policy agnostic. We only work with LGBT candidates. And then the Victory Institute is we do candidate trainings. We invest in elected officials, helping them move up the process, training and so forth. But on the fund side, we don't just endorse every LGBTQ candidate. In 2018, For example, there were more than 700 out candidates who ran across the United States.
700?
700. We reached out to a little over 400. We formally screened more than 300. I believe we endorsed 291 candidates. And so what we're looking for is candidates who have a path to victory and who can get across the finish line and represent their constituents. And since we don't do policy, we don't grade them on, you know, what their position is on immigration or infrastructure. We look and see whether they are competent and credible and they're running a good campaign and they're a good fit for their district. Our win rate historically has been in the mid-60s, and that's where we like it to be. Pete had a different problem. And let me back up again. We didn't endorse him when he put his exploratory committee together. We didn't endorse him when he formally entered the race. We actually watched him for 6 months, and we told him he had to prove himself on a level playing field with all of those other candidates, many of whom are among the best-known names in American politics.
So how did he prove himself?
And over again. He qualified for the debate stage. He soared in the polls. He took everything that was thrown at him. He appeared in, you know, he did every media interview. He never once let us down. He never once went off message. He was a phenomenal candidate. What he wasn't was known to the majority of Americans. He started from a standing start when most of the other candidates, people like Biden and Sanders, had been running for years. And most of the other candidates had been well into their campaigns when he came in. And while I think being a mayor is the best training for any political office, he was starting from a mid-sized Midwestern city. He had a funny last name. Oh, and yeah, he's gay, but man, he speaks seven languages and he's brilliant and all these other things. But he had to introduce himself. No one knew who the heck he was. So we believe he did an exemplary job as a candidate, but he didn't have enough runway to get to where he needed to go.
You think it was right for him to step out of the race before Super Tuesday?
Yes. I'm not privy to the strategic conversation that went on in his campaign, but there's nothing wrong with being a long shot candidate if you can see a path to victory. But when you can no longer see a path to victory, and there are other candidates who you can hurt by staying in the race, get out of the way. And I think that's what he did. And, I mean, Amy Klobuchar did the same thing, Elizabeth Warren. But earlier in the race, Kamala Harris. I mean, as Victory, we are no longer involved in the presidential campaign because we only work with LGBTQ candidates. We don't endorse allies. I mean, I personally am going to be all in for Joe Biden. But he would have been perhaps my fifth choice for president. But yeah, that's the way politics works.
So you're voting for the person who you believe is most electable at this point.
I believe that I'm voting for the person I believe is best fit for the job, not necessarily the most electable, but I believe he is also the most electable.
You know, at this point, we have just Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden as the two viable Democratic candidates in this race. What do you make of the fact that the most diverse presidential primary field in history has whittled down to just two straight, older, white men?
I think it has a lot to do with Donald Trump. I think the fact that we had the most diverse field in American history has partly to do with Donald Trump. There has been an explosion of candidates in 2018 and now again in 2020, of women, of candidates of color, of LGBTQ candidates, people who have never run for office before, immigrant candidates who were saying, this is not the country that I want. He doesn't represent me. This is not how I think America ought to be. If no one else is going to run, I'm going to run. And it's been beautiful to watch and to work with. And we now have enough people in that pipeline. You have to, the criticism of Pete, here's a mayor of a mid-sized American city running for president. You have to have people in the political pipeline who are at a level ready to step into the game. Well, we now have women senators and women governors, who people who are who have that executive experience, who have the profile, who are ready to run. We're getting to where we have critical mass. So that's another aspect of it. But what I think ultimately it came down to is everyone is so desperate. Two-thirds of America, three-fourths of America is so desperate to beat Donald Trump that they're trying to, instead of saying, who's the best person to lead the United States of America, they're trying to say, who can we get who can beat Trump? And I'm not going to take any chances.
If we can look at Biden and Sanders' platform, when it comes to LGBTQ rights, what do you make of it?
So today, well, actually every year, the Democratic Party gets better and better on LGBTQ issues. Both of them are good on our issues. Both of them have evolved on our issues, but the whole country has evolved on our issues. And there's no comparison to where the, you know, the Trump-Pence platform is. And there are any lesbians that I know of, but I know gay men who support Donald Trump. That's fine. They cannot do that and also say that he has been good for the LGBT community. And they can't do it and say that he has been less than hurtful to the trans community.
Do you think you'll see an LGBTQ president in your lifetime?
I sincerely hope so. Yes, I'll go ahead and say yes, and I say that because, there are no secrets in politics. I have a Wikipedia page. I'm 63 years old. And I hope I'll be around long enough to see it. But if you had asked me when I started out as an activist in the 70s if we would have marriage, if you'd asked me if we could be elected as governors, there's two U.S. governors who are LGBT. As senators, there are two big city mayors. I think there's six right now. I would have said that wasn't possible. Could we have marriage? Not in my lifetime. So, yeah, in my lifetime, we'll have an openly LGBT president.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anise Parker is the president and CEO of the Victory Fund and former mayor of Houston. Mayor Parker, once again, thank you. That's it for us today. You can follow me on Twitter at Duarte Geraldino. Also, if you missed anything or want to listen again or share our show, check out our podcast and call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. So good to be with you. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and you're listening to The Takeaway.